This is undeniably a bumper year for elections. By the end of 2024, polls will have taken place in at least 64 countries, affecting around 2 billion voters, so about a quarter of the world's population, which is staggering. One great example is the huge-scale Indian elections, with more than 640 million voters, which took around 6 weeks to complete. However, elections don't necessarily equate to democracy, and the extent to which they actually affect the way countries run, and by whom, can vary dramatically depending on where they're held. So, on this week's show, we're talking about democracy and how the UN is supporting it. Welcome to UN Weekly. I'm Conor Lennon. As you can see, today I'm in my home studio, and yes, those are real books behind me. I've even read some of them. I've been coughing all week. I don't want to infect my colleagues or today's guests with anything nasty, so I'm stuck here at home. We have a very subcontinental feel to today's show, as I'm joined by Sachin Gaur from the UN News Hindi Unit and Yoshita Singh from the Press Trust of India. Thanks to both of you for getting into the studio and for bearing with me as I get over this cough. Let me start with you, Sachin. For listeners out there who don't know that UN News can be read, seen and heard in many languages, including Hindi, just give us a quick word for your Hindi fans in Hindi.
Thanks, Connor, for having me on the show today. I hope you feel better soon. UN News Hindi was the ninth addition to the UN News family. UN News is available in 10 different languages. We provide comprehensive multimedia news coverage of UN-related issues from humanitarian aid, peace and security, and sustainable development. Most of our audience are based in India, of course, but of course there are Hindi is spoken in several different countries, and there are large Indian diaspora communities around the world. So we do have a presence in different geographical regions. If you are interested in international issues, want to learn more about the role of the UN in resolving conflicts, addressing current challenges like climate change, then all this information is available on Hindi website and in 9 different languages. तो आप हमारी वेबसाइट पर आइए, आपका बहुत बहुत स्वागत है. वी कीप एन आई मोस्टली प्राइमरीली फोकस ऑन द ग्लोबल न्यूज एजेंडा, बट कीप अ क्लोज आई ऑन द इंडियन सबकॉन्टिनेंट रीजन.
एंड योशिता, ब्रीफली टेल अस व्हाट द प्रेस ट्रस्ट ऑफ इंडिया इज, प्लीज.
Thank you, Connor, for having me here today. It's my first time, and I hope you feel better soon. So Press Trust of India, PTI, it's India's largest news buyer, the oldest news buyer. It was established in 1949, so 2 years after independence. And PTI disseminates news to its subscribers, hundreds of subscribers, which includes TV channels, newspapers, agencies, and other departments and other clients. We have about 400 journalists spread all across the country and also in the world's capitals. And the cornerstone of PTI's news has been unbiased, accurate, credible news information that goes all across the country through the wire service. We have a print service, a video service and photo division, and our news is also translated in Hindi and other languages. So clearly PTI's reach is across the length and breadth of the country. And like I said, the cornerstone is accurate and credible news source, news information.
Yeah, and those cornerstones are increasingly becoming important in this very fractured news environment. But we'll talk about that a bit later, the problems of misinformation. Let's just stick with the Indian election for just a moment. Both of you are Indian. I'm sure that you have both been consumed by the coverage. I'm thinking of all the elections taking place in much smaller countries, and there are so many stories and subplots going on. I'm just wondering how you can possibly keep on top of an election where it takes 6 weeks just to count the votes. I mean, if you look at the UK election campaign, the whole campaign is 6 weeks. The French campaign is much less than that. So, let me start with you, Yoshita. I mean, you and your colleagues, the way you're covering this election, is it possible to keep on top of it?
Yes, the Indian elections, as you've mentioned, the scale, you know, 7 phases, 6 weeks, over about a billion registered voters, so 900 and around 68 million registered voters, 640 million votes cast. So it's incredible. I mean, just the scale and the whole operation of the Indian elections, it's mammoth. But it has been conducted, as always, in a very, in a transparent manner. The systems are in place, the checks and balances are in place to ensure that the votes are counted properly, and also the whole system, the Election Commission and the machinery works as such that to reach the last mile voter. You know, a lot of infrastructure has been put in place to ensure that even if there is one or two persons in a remote town, in a remote village, the election officers will go to them, get their vote, and so to ensure that each vote is counted, each vote is taken. This year, for the first time, there was the facility of voting from home for people who are 85 years and above, or those who have disabilities, 40% disabilities. So really, the entire infrastructure and the machinery has been put in place to ensure each vote is taken, each vote matters, and each vote counts.
Yes, I've been reading some of those stories, Ishita, about the legendary Indian bureaucracy and some of the lengths that people go, that election officers go to get to these extremely remote places just to capture the vote of a handful of people. It's really impressive. And for you, Sachin, you're based in New York, when I'm in the office, but you must have been in touch with friends and family. Has there been election fever in India?
Yeah, I mean, as Yoshita mentioned some figures, that gives you an idea of the scale and size of the entire election process. From the, you know, foothills of the Himalayan region to the coastal areas of Tamil Nadu, of course, it's a massive exercise. If it can be overwhelming, it lasted for 44 days this year. In 2019, it lasted for 39 days. So usually it's conducted in phases. And yes, you know, people in India and outside India, they are very much interested in knowing about the election results. It can be a long wait. It can look overwhelming, if particularly if you're looking from outside. But I guess that makes it all the more fascinating. And due to latest technologies and social media platforms, you are always getting information in sort of real time. And you are in touch with your family, your friends, as you mentioned. So, yeah, so even if you are living far away, you are very much closer to the election exercise.
Yoshita, last year we had lots of warnings in the build-up to this bumper election year of attempts to manipulate elections around the world by spreading misinformation through social media. It just goes back to what I was saying about the importance of having unbiased, impartial information. In India, was that a big concern? Has that been a big concern this year as well?
Of course, so misinformation, disinformation, fake news has been a concern in India, in the Indian elections, as they have been and will be in other elections that happen in other parts of the world. You know, the WhatsApp forwarded messages, social media accounts, there's just now so much more avenues where misinformation can be spread and people then consume that misinformation or disinformation. And I think in this particular election, you know, what we've seen is the use of AI-generated video and audio content, which makes it difficult for people, you know, on the ground who don't have access to tools to differentiate whether the AI-generated video they're watching is accurate, it's fake, it's real. I mean, it all looks real to a common person. So the tools are not there, which is required, not just in the Indian election, in the Indian context, but for any election. We're going to head into the US election soon. So that clearly has been a point of concern, a matter of concern, but there have been stakeholders, media organizations, civil society, for instance, PTI. I would add here that PTI has a fact-checked unit within its editorial department that ensures that the news that's going out from PTI on the PTI wires is accurate, it's credible, it's fact-checked. So a lot of these such institutions have put in place these checks and balances to ensure the misinformation and disinformation, fake news campaigns can be curtailed, can be corrected. But it really requires much more to be done from both from the government, from the tech companies, to ensure that their platforms are not misused. We've seen the misuse of such platforms in the previous elections, and with AI, it's only going to get worse and more serious and concerning. So, of course, that has been the issue, but all people on their ends are trying, and I think we really need to take more efforts to ensure, you know, the people are aware as to what is fake news, what they're consuming, whether it's real, not real, and how do we then tackle that?
Well, at the UN, a lot of work has been done on tackling misinformation at a global level. Sachin, you recently spoke to Amandeep Singh Gill, the UN envoy on technology, about the influence of tech, including new AI tools on elections. He said it all adds up to a significant moment.
More than half the world is going to the polls this year, large democracies like India and the United States. And elections and debate around elections, debate on positions, is based on facts and assessments. And if we don't have a shared basis for assessing facts, then we have a problem. And the legitimacy of political processes can be undermined. So AI brings in new power and new scale to misinformation and disinformation. And that is worrying. Misinformation, disinformation has been around for a while. Tech tools have been used in the past to distort the information space. But now you have greater plausibility. For example, deep fakes made with generative AI can literally mimic the behavior, the diction, movements of people. There are recent examples where, you know, near and dear ones have also been fooled by such deep fakes. So you can imagine if, you know, certain kinds of words are put into the mouth of leaders, then it can incite outrage, unrest, and just, you know, turn people away from what they perceive as a shared basis for assessing reality. So over a period of time, you could even come to a situation where we don't trust sources of information that we have usually relied on. So that is a serious concern.
Okay, so a serious concern, as Amandeep Gill says, Sachin, but did he propose any solutions?
Yes, of course. He highlights the need to counter this challenge on multiple levels. He says that a response rooted in human rights principle is critical, and that we must strike a balance between protecting fundamental freedoms and countering misinformation and disinformation. He advocates for a new type of literacy. We need to educate citizens in sifting truth from nonsense, in being more responsible when it comes to sharing and forwarding misinformation. He also emphasizes on the need to work collaboratively with the private sector and other stakeholders, including the tech community, academia, international organizations. In his view, this is not something that should only be left to governments to deal with. We must also invest in tools and mechanisms that support independent fact-checking with the participation of journalists and the civil society. And also, he talks about the ongoing negotiation for a global digital compact ahead of the Summit of the Future, scheduled to be held later this year. The focus on digital public infrastructure, human rights online, digital trust and safety. So to that end, I just want to mention quickly that UN has been developing policy briefs, guidelines and frameworks for handling misinformation and disinformation. And there has been a focus on developing a code of conduct for information integrity on digital platforms.
And of course, we'll have the links to some of those areas you were talking about. The information integrity is really interesting. That's going to be in the show notes. The UN also does a lot to support elections and democracy, and that's, of course, the main theme of today's show. As ever, our resident explainer, Pauline Batista, breaks it down in 60 seconds.
Hi, I'm Pauline Batista, and this is the UN Explained. Now, how does the UN support democracy? With elections coming up, there's a lot happening, and the lines seem to be blurred. The opening words of the UN Charter, "We the peoples," reflect the fundamental principle of democracy, that the will of the people should rule above all. The UN promotes good governance, monitors elections, and supports civil society to make democratic institutions stronger and more accountable. The UN also ensures self-determination in decolonized countries and assists in the drafting of new constitutions in post-conflict nations. I know that was a lot of information, but would you like to learn more? You can go to news.un.org and search democracy.
Thanks as ever to Pauline. So this year we have huge amount of elections taking place around the world. In some cases, this is going to mean a real change in leadership. In others, the votes won't affect the way the country's governed. At the same time, some governments are becoming increasingly repressive to the concern of the UN, which promotes inclusive, effective, and accountable governance. To find out more about the way the UN supports democracy, I spoke earlier to Sarah Lister, the head of governance at the UN Development Programme, and Ian Walker, the CEO of New Democracy, an NGO which has organised several citizens' assemblies, some with the support of the UN Democracy Fund, which have had a big impact on national policies. I started by asking Sarah Lister if initiatives like citizens' assemblies, which bring together a representative sample of people to find common ground on a particular issue, could be an antidote to the polarisation that seems to be so prevalent today.
I think we are in need of democratic renewal in many ways, in many societies. And it's really important that people are given more opportunities for their voices to be heard, for their opinions to be taken into account. And I think recent surveys have said that 2 out of 3 people say that they don't think that their voices are heard in political systems. And I think that's part of the reason that we see in many places this so-called backlash against democracy, that we have formal systems in place and yet people feel that their voices are not being heard. So citizens' assemblies, citizen juries are one way, I think, as Ian says, which is complementary to formal processes of representative democracy. And there are other ways as well. And all of them are predicated on a kind of a range of democratic institutions that need to be in place in society for them to function well. There needs to be open civic space. There needs to be civic literacy amongst people. So part of what we're doing at UNDP is broadening the conversation beyond that of just elections and saying, what do societies need to have in place and what are the institutions and processes for democratic principles to be at play?
Well, I saw you nodding there, Ian, and as someone who's been on the ground in these examples of what you said are fairly early stage democracies, what was the follow through? I.e., you've had this great experience, people feel empowered around a particular issue. Was there then follow through to a higher level in terms of governance?
Connor, you've asked the wonderful question. I was hoping you would. We didn't even have to stage it. In each of those instances, courtesy of a UN Democracy Fund grant, we were able to empower a local team. Now, in each case in Brazil, in North Macedonia, in Malawi, each of these people taking this method for the very first time has now gone on to do future and other projects in this field. So effectively, it was a seeding and a catalyst, because in democracy and politics, you need a story. You need a practical real-world example of something working. And if I look at Delibera in Brazil, or the Zip Institute in Malawi, or Edwin working in Malawi there, in each case, all of a sudden they got a first project that told a story of here's a hard problem and it got fixed. That was regional and municipal waste in northern Brazil, COVID policy in North Macedonia, and use of community development funds in Malawi. And you started to show to leaders, particularly in political office, this is a helpful, useful mechanism. Where many people in politics tend to look at what is community engagement as self-selected groups of people yelling at them. And the minute you go to random selected groups of people thinking, the result is transformationally different. So what we've seen is the impact. All those organizations years later are still going out and doing projects in this field in new and different countries. I hope we get the chance to go into 10 more.
Well, it's all very encouraging, and I'm sure as well, you're doing great work in many other countries, Sarah, but this is all fine when everyone is working towards the same objective and everyone has, I guess, an honest interest in this. But there are bad actors out there as well. And what do you do in that situation when you are in a situation where, for example, the people in power are anti-democratic? They don't have interests in hearing everyone's views. what are the limitations on what you can achieve? And I'll start with you, Sarah.
Well, that's obviously an excellent question. And there's not one simple answer. I mean, I would premise it by saying that it's important that we are working before we get to that situation also, so that governments and other authorities are able to deliver for people, and that public sectors are delivering and governance is functioning well. So prevention is important in this. But there are contexts which are very complicated, and we all know of them. But in our experience, there are always pockets of democracy and pockets of people, champions for democratic values in different spaces and places. And sometimes that means working more at local governance level. Sometimes it means working within sectoral initiatives. Sometimes it means going a level up and actually looking at regional opportunities to support democratic principles. So it is around looking for different entry points and different processes that can be used to keep space open for democratic action of different types. That is how we would approach it.
But democracy is hard work, isn't it, Ian? You know, you have to invite people to come to these workshops. They have to spend time with you. Democracy can be messy. It doesn't always immediately lead to a clear answer. And the thing that authoritarians, populists can sell is a clear, seemingly a simple message, a cut through to all these discussions and all the rest of it. And if people aren't as engaged as the people in your workshops, that can be quite a seductive thing. Someone once said, didn't they, democracy is the worst form of government apart from all the other ones.
Yeah.
So why should we stick with democracy? I'll start with you, Ian.
Why should we stick with it? Because people want to have a say in the decisions that affect their lives. And that's the unifying piece. You know, Malawi is one of the poorer countries on earth. I live in Australia, in one of the wealthier countries on earth, and what I see in people's response is the same thing. I want to have a say. People are capable if we give them the opportunity, and citizens' assemblies, kind of like the criminal jury, are a format where your decision matters. Now, of course, there can be barriers to participation, and Connie, you mentioned bad actors. Anything can be cheated. I mean, you can cheat an election in many different ways. You can cheat a citizens' assembly. And the defense is to have a very simple set of principles where if it is breached, that those looking at it can tell. Rules around the random selection. If this is done out of house, not within a government, it's very hard to manipulate a lottery selection. Connor, if I could manipulate a lottery, I wouldn't be sitting here talking to you. I would have bought an island. On the information side, of course, you can curate only one side of an argument and push it down people's throat. But a design that always allows the citizens to pick their own sources is a great shock absorber for that. So I won't do chapter and verse, but why I'm optimistic on democracy is you see it everywhere. People want to have a say, and so when they get invited, they turn up.
Well, that's nearly it for today. But before we go, Yoshita has a prop with her. Yoshita, please show us your prop and tell us what it is.
So it is a yoga mat, because 21st June is the International Day of Yoga. And
And you are, there's a professional looking yoga mat she's getting out there, bright blue, as proof. Sachin, where's yours? I'm hoping you're as flexible as, flexible than me anyway.
I'm a yoga enthusiast, but I'll be watching it from a distance tomorrow. I'll be reporting it for UN News. I do some basic breathing exercises called pranayama, but for now, that's about it.
Okay, I must try some of this stuff. Well, you're both good at yoga then, are you? Yoshita, clearly, you can do all the really bendy stuff, turning yourself in various poses, and do you enjoy it?
So I do the Surya Namaskar, which is one of the most popular yoga asanas. It has 12 postures in it, 12 asanas in the Surya Namaskar, sun salutation. It's really a whole body exercise. There are people who do 108 Surya Namaskars, and that's what they say is required, but I'm not there yet. So I won't give the number that I do, but yeah, that's one exercise. Breathing exercises, as Sachin mentioned, stretching. It really helps calm the mind and helps the body. Yeah.
I mean, yoga, of course, is indelibly associated with India, has these ancient roots in India. But is it still popular? Is it something that most people in India would do, or is that a cliche?
No, of course, yoga is very, very popular. And I think, Connor, especially after the COVID pandemic, you know, when there has been so much focus on our physical well-being, our mental well-being, mental health, and just to keep our sanity and peace of mind. So yoga is not just exercise. You know, you can do yoga to, again, there are breathing exercises. It's a part of meditation. Some people take it as a spiritual exercise. So there's so many aspects to yoga, and it is very popular, and a lot of people do it, youngsters do it. And I think the best part about yoga is you don't need a whole gym setup. I mean, you can start at any age, you can do as much as you can. You can choose the asanas that you want that help you in whichever way possible. And there's no particular time of the day. You can do it in the morning, afternoon, evening. Breathing exercises, you can do it while you're commuting. So I think there's so much benefits to yoga. And just after the pandemic, a lot of people have taken, I mean, I personally took up yoga, especially after the pandemic. It helps, like I said, in so many ways, and it becomes a part of your life, because if you do it in a certain way, the discipline that it brings to your life, the practice when you do it, it just becomes a part of your life, and you feel that you're missing out on something if you don't do your yoga exercises. At least that's for me.
And well, you both look in prime health, so something's going right. As for those who were wondering what Sachin was referring to, so we're recording just before the International Day of Yoga, and every year there's a big yoga session on the North Lawn of the UN, which is a lot of fun. And there was one at Times Square, I believe, earlier on the day we're recording, that you were at, Yoshita, usually full of tourists, but I guess today full of yoga enthusiasts, which must have been lots of fun. Well, okay, so it seems that you are both, shall we say, yoga experts. So I thought I would test your knowledge. Okay, so I'm going to ask you three questions, and I want to see if you get this right. So let's start with the first question. I want to know which of these is not a real yoga pose: crow, raven, or crane?
What did you say? Crow, raven, or crane?
Yeah. What do you think? I'll start with you, Yoshita.
I would say raven.
You're going with raven, Sachin?
Possibly raven.
Looking blank.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. Of course it's raven. Absolute nonsense. Here's another one then. This is all about pigeons. One-legged king pigeon, flying pigeon, swooping pigeon. I know they all sound a bit unlikely.
Swooping pigeon, I guess.
Okay. Yoshita?
I would go with flying pigeon. I don't know. Flying pigeon, maybe.
Swooping pigeon is completely made up. Well done, Sachin. And the last one, two-legged inverted staff, double diamond, or two-limbed plank?
Double diamond, I would say.
Well, full marks for the innovative nomenclature.
You're going with double diamond, Yoshita. Sachin?
No idea.
Okay, the made-up one was, of course, double diamond, which is a kind of beer which has been around for a very long time in England. It's not the greatest beer as well. So I think you did extremely well there. You really proved that you know what you're talking about. So thank you very much for taking part in that, and also for taking part in today's show. On the show today, we have been shedding light on the way the UN supports democracy, and hopefully we've inspired you to try out some body-bending yoga poses. A reminder, a bunch of useful links will be in the show notes, and your feedback is important to us. Please send your comments, thoughts, and suggestions to unweekly@un.org. Studio production was by the UN TV team. The editor was Grace Barrett. The executive producer was Mita Hassali. UN Weekly is a UN News production.